Welcome to Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, where book clubs aren't just for women, and beer makes us totally ignorant.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are talking about George Orwell's 1984. We got a lot of beer drink. Can we start with a beer?
Yeah, we definitely need to start with a beer.
I mean, what do you think?
We got a lot of those rebels.
Yeah, let's do a rebel here. I'll start with this one. So, while I open this up, 1984 is about, well, it's dystopian world in, I guess, what is England?
Right? In what year?
In 1984.
Oh, wow. Is that why it's called that? Okay.
That was this terrible totalitarian society, and the main character, Winston, notices some of the inconsistencies about it and the things that the state is lying to him about, and he starts to keep his own little journal about what he sees, because he has this one little spot in his room where he's not under surveillance, but he can write, and then he gets involved with other, perhaps legitimate or not legitimate, dissenters and rebels, hence... This is Sam Adams' Rebel Juiced IPA, a tropical twist of mango and citrusy hops.
On top of their regular Rebel IPA.
Which, we may have one of those coming our way.
It
is 55 IBUs, 6.2% alcohol, ale with mango and natural flavors. It's okay.
I mean, I've definitely had this before. I like it, but it's definitely different.
It's my least favorite of the Rebels that Sam Adams makes. They make four or five, I think five actually, Rebel IPAs. We have three of them with us today. So there's Rebel IPA, we have one of those. There's... Rebel Rouser, which is the double IPA we'll have. There's also like a blue label one. It's like Rebel Rider or something like that. Little Rebel, I don't know what it's called, but it's the low alcohol one, like the session beer. I'm not against it, they just didn't have it at the store. We got Rebel Juiced, and there's another one with grapefruit, which is really, I didn't like it. I did not like that at all. This one's pretty good. You know, it's weird. Sam Adams took a long time to make an IPA. For years, Sam Adams was the biggest craft brewer that I knew about that didn't make an IPA.
They were kind of the original craft brewer.
Yeah, historically. I mean, there are some before them, some other examples, like Anchor Brewing Companies are not longer. New Albion or something like that was the first craft beer in the 60s, beer nerds will argue. But Sam Adams was the big one, especially over here on the East Coast. You know, they're from Boston. You can get this beer all the time. They had a lot of catchy ads in the 90s, like... I'll have a Sam Adams commercial and stuff. But they did not make an IPA. They had lots of more German-style beers, Black Lager and Bock and stuff like that. Lagers in general, which the A in IPA is ale, the not lager type of beer. And then they came out with a couple of IPAs a few years ago that were okay, and then those kind of, you don't see those anymore. They were like, I don't even remember what they were called, Whitewater or something like that. They had a bunch of okay IPAs, and then now they've had this line of Rebel IPAs that are all pretty solid. I'd say Dribble Juice is one of the weaker showings, but...
It's different.
Well, you know, a lot of IPAs have, especially if they use American hops, you get that tropical mango or citrusy kind of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So this has that, and they just augmented it. So, back to the book. 1984, Winston finds out about... Or he starts noticing things, he's writing things down. He meets a female named Julia, and they bone a lot, and that's how they...
That's being a rebel.
It's pretty... Yeah, that's... Yeah, I was going to make a joke, but I totally don't know what it was. And there's the only other major character is O'Brien, who is a guy who's like an inner party member, and Winston knows him, sees him at work, essentially. So the party is the group that controls the society.
Yeah, this is a totalitarian government. I mean, he says he lives in London, but this is like futuristic science fiction. Even though it's not very sciencey, but it's, you know, it's futuristic science fiction under a totalitarian government, and O'Brien is like way up there in the party that controls the entire government. But Winston thinks, or he suspects, that maybe O'Brien is a rebel like him, maybe a secret rebel. Even though he says in public all the things you're supposed to say, secretly he harbors these ideas that maybe the party is wrong. And then he and Julia go to his house. And finds out that O'Brien can turn off his television, the one that monitors everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Turns off the monitoring and can talk about whatever he wants because he's trusted as part of the party. But O'Brien gives Winston and Julia a book, and it's just called The Book, or it's the book within the book.
Yes, it was written by Emmanuel Goldstein, who is the enemy of the state.
Right,
he is this. Freethinker who argues that he points out all the, in the book, he points out all of the lies and strategies that the Big Brother party government uses to keep people essentially in bondage.
Mm-hmm.
And O'Brien gives this book to Winston, and then Winston reads it, which means you read it in the book.
Yeah, it's a big chunk of the book.
And a lot of it you kind of have figured out along the way, but it makes it all very, very clear.
Yeah. Spells out why everything is happening.
That was probably the most boring part of the book for me, because I kind of knew a lot about it already.
But it's really important.
It's true.
It was Orwell's, like, really political message of the book. That's where he actually spells out what he meant by all this stuff. Now, whether that's good writing or not, totally different question, but definitely spells it out. And then Winston, what does he do? Does he try to rebel? What does he do? I know he gets captured.
They capture him. So him and Julie have been going to, like, in the slummy part of the city where it's like the proles that don't really do anything. They're not politically active. They've been going there to fuck in some sort of motel situation at this guy's shop. Hmm. And it turns out that they've been talking to each other about what's wrong with Big Brother in the state and what they would like to do instead. But it turns out that the guy running that shop is an agent of the state. And they've been watching all along, and they've followed everything.
And so was O'Brien.
Like, yep.
This was all an elaborate trick, elaborate plot to get Winston to, you know, be captured, and other rebels.
Yeah, which is an interesting strategy to catch rebels, lure them in, and then, I mean, I guess it works, but it seems like a long way to go instead of just waiting for them to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they get caught, and then they are taken to whatever center to be interrogated.
The Ministry of Love.
Yes, where they are interrogated / tortured. Taken into room 101 eventually, which is the room where it's not really clear. It's the room where the worst thing in the world is for you. Whatever it is. That Big Brother knows about everybody so well that they know what is the absolute worst thing you could imagine. And then they will use that against you in this room to break you.
Mm-hmm.
And for Winston, it's rats.
Yeah.
So they torture him. They beat the shit out of him for I don't know how long. And he says basically everything they want. He is a broken man. But in his heart and his mind, he feels like he hasn't truly given in because he hasn't betrayed Julia.
Yeah.
And then they take him to room 101, the room with the worst thing in the world.
And they put a cage with rats in it on his face.
Yes.
Which is the thing he's most afraid of. He's just most afraid of rats. And so in order to make that stop, he finally gives up Julia. Even though they knew it already.
Well, he doesn't give her up. He says, do it to her.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Not me. Right? That's the ultimate betrayal mm-hmm. for him. And then after that, O'Brien satisfied, they've broken Winston. Now he knows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how it ends. He gets... Well, actually, they give him, like, better dentures or something like that because they've, like, knocked out half his teeth. And he has a better-fitting denture. And they
it's a happy ending.
They take care of... Like, he had some sort of medical... Something wrong with his leg. Some sort of, like... I don't know, inflammation or something. Something like rash or something. I forget what it was. But they take care of that. They, like, kind of heal him. And at the very end of the book, the last four words are haunting. It says, he loved Big Brother. Though, the Ministry of Love, like, the meaning of love is kind of corrupt in the book. So what does that exactly mean? I guess it's somewhat debatable. But they break him. He loses.
Yeah.
The state wins. Being a rebel didn't pay off for Winston or Julia because they see each other one more time and they both look at each other knowing that they've betrayed each other. In no real terms, like they haven't, you know, cheated on each other or hurt each other directly, but just because they were willing to give the other one up to Big Brother to save himself.
Under torture.
Their relationship is over. So it is a downer. It's based off a lot of historical influences. So when it was written in 1948, and Orwell just swapped the last 2 years of mm-hmm. the year he was writing.
To make it seem like it's far in the future, he just swapped the numbers, and that's why he made it 1984, the futuristic year of 1984, which obviously for us is a little weird because that was a long time ago.
Yep, a little before my time. Nate was still wearing diapers.
I was alive, yes.
So it's supposed to be the future. Of course, it's no longer the future for us. Though I imagine if you were alive in like 1982, 1983, and an adult and knew the book, it must have been kind of exciting to see 1984 on the calendar coming up.
You know, like when it turned January 1st, 1999, and everyone was playing that Prince song.
Yes, that's true, yeah. They also played that same fucking Prince song.
Every year.
2000.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The last day. Because the whole thing of like partying, like it's 1999, like it's the end of the world or whatever. So the book has a lot of things that were happening when Orwell wrote it, influenced it. So 1948, right after World War II. This is at the very start of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. The term Cold War wasn't even really around yet. People mostly didn't understand what was about to happen. And even though the United States and the Soviet Union were totally becoming enemies, they were already enemies for sure. And they were already challenging each other. But really what would turn into the full scope of the Cold War wasn't really understood yet.
No, definitely the term wasn't used. I think historians argue when the Cold War starts. It's not declared.
Yeah.
But at this 1948, the Soviets don't have the atomic bomb yet. So no. You could argue perhaps the Cold War hasn't quite begun. though you can get really radical and say the Cold War started the moment they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, or you can even say the Cold War started with the Treaty of Versailles. You know, you can find all sorts of different things to argue. So he's writing under that time, whatever we're calling it. Stalin is in power in Russia and has been at that point for like 20 years and will be for another five until he dies. So he is a totalitarian regime, and a lot of the things in this book are just borrowed from stories out of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, he's specifically writing about the dangers of totalitarianism, as he's seen happen under the Soviet Union. And in fact, Animal Farm, Orwell's other most famous work, is also about the Soviet Union.
And the entire Russian Revolution, right?
And the Russian Revolution. And so he writes about that, but he's not only writing about... He's not only writing about the Soviet Union. I think he's also talking about Hitler in Germany. And he's talking about the dangers of totalitarianism in general. I don't think Orwell would say... Or no, it's just the Soviet Union. That was it. That's all I was worried about.
No, that is probably the most prominent ingredient, though.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, the description of Big Brother, which was something like a man in his late 40s with a small mustache... Oh, no, that's Joseph Stalin.
Right, though depending on the shape of the mustache, could be Hitler.
Could also be Hitler, yeah.
Hitler wasn't a big, tall guy. He did have a mustache. Nice little flavor saver he had there. So, almost because we have so many to drink, I'm going to open this next beer. This is Sam Adams' regular Rebel IPA.
Right, this is the, for those following along at home, this is the red one.
Yes.
This is the middle strength one.
And for the colorblind, go fuck yourself. Yeah, the historical thing of and I think Orwell was a socialist in his political
meaning. He was a leftist, for sure.
And I'm sure that just because of when he lived, he probably felt that communism was good at one point and probably was felt betrayed by the Russian Revolution, which betrayed the people of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert.
Yes, it's true, but with pigs. Rebel IPA, way better than Rebel Juiced. It's a little stronger, 6.5%, 45 IBUs, so it's less hoppy, but because it doesn't have that mango and other stuff in there, it tastes like more like a regular kind of standard IPA. It's not a spectacular IPA by any stretch, and I think if I were to reach for a regular IPA, not an Imperial IPA or anything like that, there are many other things I prefer than this, but it is a fine beer that you can find just about everywhere, which
good.
Is nice. So I think another, you know, just thinking about what elements of the book might not be from Stalin, and the two-minute hate thing... That sounds vaguely Nazi-ish.
Yeah.
So the two-minute hate is this moment every day at some point where all activity stops for people to just get fired up about the thing that the government, the country, all the people within it really hate. So they'll be shown images.
And there are TV screens everywhere, which, of course, in 1948 when he was writing this one, that was super futuristic. I mean, today, not that weird. But anyway, there would be shows... pictures on the TV of what everybody's supposed to hate, and people would like yell and scream and chant hateful things, and that's just what you did for at least 2 minutes a day.
Right.
What everybody did together for those 2 minutes.
And it sounds like the sort of political rally where, you know, the politician or the demagogue holds up the image or points out the image of the person that's making your life less good. Like, oh, if I were in 1933, I expect that would be the Jews, and how we need to hate them. They are the problem. We have to get rid of them. And it is this strategy that they use in 1984, the government uses, to unite the people, in addition to all the other ways that they're kind of bound together, to unite them against the enemy of the state, which, according to the book, doesn't really exist or matter, the enemy of the state.
Right, yeah.
It's all fiction created by the state to keep the people doing what it wants.
And we'll definitely talk more about that.
The other thing, you know, that makes it futuristic, the technology, you kind of mentioned it, there is, you know, not only does everyone have a television in every room, in every house, in every hallway, like everything is surveilled. You could watch the state government things, but they could see you through the television.
Yeah, every television more or less has an eye at the top or a little camera at the top. In the government, you could be watching you at all times. Or maybe not, but you don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't like turn on or off. So it's kind of like, you know, your standard run-of-the-mill appliance today
that right, yeah.
listens to you and records your conversations.
And tweets on your behalf.
Yes, right? It's Siri.
You need more milk.
So the technology there is really crazy. Everything else is actually not futuristic, right? There's no space travel. There's no, you know, aliens. It's just...
He does mention that because this takes place in 1984. There was a nuclear war in the 1950s, which, you know, was forward-thinking at the time. And he does talk about how the battleships got bigger. He has a word for it. I forget what it is. The flying floating fortresses, something like that. Anyway, there is some futuristic technology, but that's not really what the book is about.
But that's really not that radical to think about. It's just an extension of the shit he had just seen in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, bigger ships? Sure. The ships grew from the start of the war to the end of the war, which is 4 or 5 years, right? nuclear weapons, sure, they dropped atomic bombs, and then very quickly developed the hydrogen bomb and had even more powerful weaponry. So to imagine it would be used, not that crazy a thought. No. So the technology thing is the only thing that makes it science fiction. I think really more this is classified as like a dystopian novel. In fact, this might be the book really where that term is coined.
The most influential dystopian novel.
Yeah, we've done a few on the show now. This is the biggest. And you could see its fingerprints on the other ones that we've read. Right, so we read
Definitely.
The Handmaid's Tale, and we've read Fahrenheit 451. Both of them have influences from this book. And any dystopian book since then has influences from it. So what is the legacy of the book in literature?
In literature?
Sure, like in the dystopian world, is there...
I mean, besides what you already said, that every dystopian book since then has definitely traced some of its ideas back to 1984. I would even argue the Hunger Games, like the world of the Hunger Games, is also kind of similar to 1984, or at least there are elements in which the government is all-powerful, you know, they're always watching you all the time, and it's this little group of maybe rebels that does something about it. But even sure. even contemporary dystopian science fiction, you know, teen novels, are also based on 1984.
And there's its legacy extends past literature, which we'll get to that too, because that might be where it's even more important. Why is the book, I'm not going to say if, or is, it is, but why is the book relevant today?
Well, okay, this is the big question. There are many different ways in which we could say it's relevant today. I'll just pick one to start, and then you can pick up where I leave off. In 1984, it's the world of surveillance, where the government could be and probably is watching you all the time. And they're watching you specifically to see if you're behaving the right way, that you're acting the right way, that you're not expressing any form of dissent, that you're not expressing any form of speaking out against the government.
No thought crimes.
No, and thought crimes is what they would be called in the book. And yeah, we all know what that means. Now, here's the thing. We are both living in the United States. Is the government really doing that right now? Well, no. But sort of yes. But no, if you really want to get into it. Even if we, like, put aside Facebook and Twitter and all the things we post for ourselves that we just give away, okay, this is going to sound like conspiracy theory. The NSA and the CIA, they just pick up everything. Their technology is based around picking up every single cell phone call, email, internet, whatever. They collect information about everyone in the world. And even though their mandate is not to look at people in the United States, and their software is supposed to eliminate Americans from their databases, and essentially it doesn't, because there is no good practical way to eliminate Americans from the rest of the data that they pick up, which is almost everything. Hmm. So, in a large way, everyone in the United States is being spied on, at least a little bit.
Sure, and you know you can go look at. You know, that more overt things like surveillance cameras. There are cameras in public places that are recording shit, and if you go through there, you just kind of accept that you're going to be recorded. Now, it's different in other parts of the world, right? So England, where this takes place, you cannot find a corner in London, apparently, that is not being recorded somehow.
Millions of cameras.
It's obscene. Like, everything is covered. Now, you know, some people think that's a good idea, some people think it's a bad idea. It doesn't really matter, but it just, to me, whether it's good or bad, it shows some thing that he kind of predicted, right, that we'd be watched more. But you brought up, you know, you kind of said before, if we could discard Facebook and Twitter, we're still being surveilled. But I'd say because of those things, because of our social media predilections, especially younger people, we just give that information away. The government doesn't have to be sneaky and take it. The government doesn't have to hide a camera.
That is something that Orwell got wrong.
Right, well, he didn't realize that there'd be a way for you to give it away and that people would somehow be incentivized to give it away.
That they would want to.
Right, and I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I have a theory why we want to just give away our information. It's really just because we want attention, and you get attention by you draw attention to yourself somehow. Mm-hmm. Well, if I show pictures of my cleavage or my outlandish beliefs or something, and say it in an inflammatory way, I'll get attention. And that's,
or all the beer I drink.
That is.
Or record my thoughts on books and put it on the internet, and we get attention. Oh my God, those depraved people.
You're assuming you get attention from putting that podcast out. I don't
know. Yeah, right? If more than 7 people listen to this.
You're right. You know, they're not. There's nothing bad about those things. But we just do it. Right? We give away that information. So the government doesn't have to go steal it. The government doesn't be sneaky and find it. The government can just, if they want it, or your future employer wants it, you can have your whole fucking life ruined on the internet if you post the wrong thing and people get a hold of it. Right? Like John Ronson book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, talks a lot about this. And he has a good TED Talk that kind of summarizes it. And all these people who said like one kind of stupid thing or had one event that was videotaped and went viral.
And then have an army of internet trolls completely ruin their life.
Yeah, right? And people give out your address and you get fired from your job and you fucking get death threats. So that's not the government. That's just regular people.
Yeah.
I'd say that's something he got wrong. He got like half wrong. He got the result right, that our information would be available to whoever wants to find it, but he didn't know the mechanism behind it.
That we would just give it away.
No, I mean, who would think? Because there was, you know, in his time, there was no way to do that.
Nope.
What would it have been if I made a TV show in 1948 where I just made The Real World 1948 and you just videotaped me and a bunch of people were hanging out in an apartment? That kind of programming didn't exist. Nobody thought about that. Like, television was only on for a few hours a day. It was extremely controlled just because it was expensive to make.
Mm-hmm.
And it was terrible to watch. So he didn't know that would happen. He could not have predicted Twitter. He could not have predicted blogs and shit like that. Or dick pics.
Here's another way that 1984 at least is somewhat relevant to real life. A really key part of the book is that the country is at war and that it has always been at war. It's just constantly at war all the time against this enemy that everyone's supposed to hate, and that's where the hate's supposed to go. I would argue that the United States has been on a war footing since Pearl Harbor. I mean, really, we declared war after the day after Pearl Harbor. The United States declared war, and we won World War II. And then since then, the military budget has only gone up.
Hmm.
It's never gone down. I mean, maybe it's gone down a little bit in some years, but the military involvement and the importance of the military has only gone up. For a long time, it was the Cold War. It was spending $1 trillion on nuclear weapons, missiles, all those kinds of things. You know, then we fought the proxy wars like Korea and then Vietnam. And then as soon as the Cold War was done, oh no, we got to take out Saddam Hussein, except not really. And every 10 years, the United States tends to just go bomb somebody.
Well, hold on. Saddam Hussein did commit genocide.
Oh, yeah, sure. Except then we left him there.
Yeah,
in 1991.
Well, we didn't finish
there
the job.
For a while, we didn't finish the job. And then anyway, even when the Cold War is over, there was a period of supposed peace in the 90s, and then after 9/11 happens, the Cold War simply just turns into the War on Terror, where it is a completely open-ended, there's no even definition of winning in this conflict. And the United States is still really on this war footing, and the United States military is still involved in all over the world, many different countries, bases all over the world, and soldiers actively fighting in many places. So I would argue that the constant warfare, the constant war, and the sort of war mentality in 1984, he got entirely right. We're still doing that today.
I'm not sure if I agree with that, but I would say that in the 90s there was shit too, right? There were like
there
Somalia
too,
and Nicaragua and places like that. We sent
in Bosnia,
right?
And Rwanda.
Right. So we sent people to other places too. I know. I don't know if it starts if that's the case. The United States is a pretty bellicose, but we fight a lot of shit. We've had conflicts pretty much all the time in one form or another, right? Before World War II, the Great Depression stopped that, maybe. But in the 20s, we fought in World War I. Wilson sent troops to Russia to help fight the Russian Revolution. Like, there was other military action in other times, too.
Yeah.
And before World War I, you know, we might have had a few years of non-intervention, but you had Teddy Roosevelt using the United States as the global policeman to make sure that things went as they'd like it to have gone in various places. And there was the Spanish-American War.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout the whole 1870s and 80s, there's all sorts of conflict within the United States between Native American groups. And so there's always been conflict. I don't know if that's...
And then there's the Civil War in the 1860s.
Right. There's the Mexican-American War in the 1840s. There's like the Black Hawk War in there somewhere. I don't know the year of that.
So you're not saying we're not at war. You're saying we've always been at war.
We've always been at war with East Asia, yeah.
We've always been at war with East Asia, exactly.
I'm not sure if I'm saying that. I mean, I just find a place, a powerful country that has not been in conflict frequently in the modern world, right? So, yeah, sure.
I'm thinking.
I mean, I'm sure there are some, but I think just the way the world works today, whether this is a product of those conflicts in the past or not.
Norway.
Okay, well, Norway has a couple things going for it. One, Norway is...
As we talked about in a podcast a couple weeks ago.
They've only had one serial killer. That's one thing.
It's just that one guy.
And they have a detective who catches them. So that helps. That's helpful. They have, you know, sort of energy independence.
Who has an abundance of body hair in unfortunate places.
They don't have to worry about energy, so they don't have to, like, if another country wants to fuck them and raise the prices of things, and that can certainly lead to conflict. They don't have to worry about that. They don't have internal strife because they're pretty much all the same culture.
Except for that one Nazi guy.
That one Nazi guy was bad. Don't let one bad Norwegian ruin the whole bunch. They have A-ha, which has put out one hell of a song. It's helpful. Sure. And Norway gets to save a lot of money by hanging out with NATO but not paying into it. And not being in the EU but getting to, like, participate in, like, nobody really gives a fuck about them. Like, they have a, they're in a good position. Do they not have conflict? No. And they also just bent over for the Nazis in World War II. So maybe they have a sour taste in their mouth from that Nazi gist. So sure, there are countries that are not as violent, but is Norway as powerful in the world either? Right, you don't get to be a powerful country if you just, like, are rather hippie-ish about things. Let's say it's good or bad, what the United States does or what Norway does, but there are big differences between the United States and Norway. What about England, where Orwell was really thinking about? They've been in tons of conflict.
Tons of conflict.
Right.
In fact, of all 220 countries in the world, they've only not been at war with, like, 20 of them.
Right.
They've been at war at some point or some sort of military action involving 200 out of 220 countries.
That's pretty impressive.
I mean, they had a couple hundred years to do all that, but, you know.
Well, also for a couple hundred years, they owned most of those countries.
Also true.
Or France. What do you think of those war-hating pussies? They've had all sorts of conflicts, too, especially in the post-colonialism kind of thing where they tried to fight to remain in control of, like, Algeria or Indochina.
Well, just and under colonialism, they were certainly not exempt from that.
No.
We only think they're peaceful because they, you know, surrendered that one time.
That one time, that's true. But it was a big one.
It was the big one. That's why they have to own it. Because it was the big one. Anyway, I think we need another one of these.
We do. We want to do this last rebel? We want to do the... let's do the... for the cycle here. So this is Rebel Rouser IPA. So this is my favorite of the rebels. Not that I'm going to tell you how to feel about it. But it's the Imperial IPA, which I just like Imperial anything, since we're talking about colonialism. Because...
Imperialism? Yeah, he's totally for that.
Just because it's bigger, a bigger beer. It stands out more, you know, when you've... After a while, most IPAs are kind of the same. It's the bigger ones that stand out to you. So this is 8.4% alcohol, 85 IBUs. Way bigger beer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like it more. It's not my favorite Imperial IPA by any stretch, but it's a really good one to find easily.
Definitely stronger.
And I gotta say, what doesn't hurt, a lot of the really great craft beer is expensive. You know, so you buy, I've bought beers where it's $10 for a 12-ounce bottle. $12 for that sometimes. You can buy a six-pack of any Sam Adams for $10. It's not quite as cheap as Coors or Budweiser. But it's a lot cheaper than going out and buying, you know, your four-pack of, Dogfish Head 90 Minute or something like that, which is like $13-14 for four beers. So for a drinker on a budget, Sam Adams puts out good stuff. I mean, there are a lot of breweries that they're, especially around here, things are kind of expensive in the city, perhaps are cheaper other places. A six-pack is $20, $18. So cheaper beer is nice. And my favorite type of beer is free beer.
Free beer, yeah.
But
speaking of which,
cheaper beer.
If you want to sponsor us and send us free beer, if you're a brewery and you would like to sponsor us,
if you're a guy that makes beer in your bathtub. Or I guess if you want to give us a book, we'll take that too.
Oh, but yeah, I guess.
I guess. So what do you make of the ending of the book?
Well, we're not even close to done as to why the book is relevant today.
That's true, but I just
we haven't talked about Trump yet.
You're right. We haven't.
You know,
the charge on that. I'll let you start that one.
All right. So if you didn't notice, after the 2016 election and after Inauguration Day, 1984 and other dystopian novels were completely sold out nationwide and probably like worldwide.
Which is amazing because nobody buys books.
Right. The libraries were also out of their copies of 1984. And Handmaid's Tale and things like that.
Well, Handmaid's Tale because they had a show. Well, stage adaptation of 1984 or something recently, too. Mm. People are revisiting the dystopian things.
But still, I just get the feeling that the election had something to do with it.
Well, I think the people who were very much against Trump in the election, the voters who did not want him to win, they wanted someone else to win, whoever that was, saw his presidency, saw his actions and words or whatever as the sort... there's lots of parallels, and I don't want to say, like, I personally don't believe this, but a lot of people start drawing parallels between Hitler or between Mussolini because they see, like, the populism of Donald Trump. And then it's not a far... If you're willing to make that connection, it's not far then to say, well, look where those things led.
Yeah.
So that's where we're going.
And whether this has turned out in real life or not, Trump's sort of rhetoric has definitely tended towards a little bit authoritarian.
Sure.
Not that those things have necessarily happened, although we're speaking in the fall of 2017. We don't really know what's going to be happening in the future.
If you find this on a cassette tape called Twisted Sister live at Carnegie Hall in a Foot Locker in Bangor, Maine.
Yeah, you'll know what happened. Did the country possibly nose slightly towards authoritarianism more than it was before? Maybe a little bit. Maybe the compass needle of government power edged a little bit further towards authoritarianism. Although, I want to say there's at least another reason why Trump does relate to this book.
What
Mike,
is that?
Mike is over here rolling his eyes. And like,
I know I haven't thought about something else. No, I'm waiting to see. Keeping
okay.
an open mind.
So,
as open as Julia's legs.
She's a rebel below the belt.
Yeah,
below the waist.
Rebel from the waist downwards.
Rebel from the waist down, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's totally me. Trump goes on and on about fake news. He says that constantly, tweets about it constantly, and then the news keeps saying constantly that he says they're fake news. I mean, that poor CNN correspondent, White House correspondent from CNN, I mean, he just gets attacked all the time. Well, you're fake news, Trump says outwardly.
Awesome.
And by
it's
the
so
way, literally in the same press conference that Trump says, oh yeah, there's definitely good people on both sides in Charlottesville. And then the CNN guy asks a question. Well, you're fake news, Trump shoots back with. Literally,
yeah.
Here's why that's a problem. It's because one of the major things that's happening in the book is that the party, like the government of 1984, they control reality by controlling information. And not just controlling information, they control what everybody thinks happened in the past.
That's true.
In fact, Winston's job is to go through old newspapers and old reports and old documents and actually change them to represent what the party itself wants. It's like we're living in a post-fact world, in a post-fact America, where the facts don't matter and the facts are whatever you want them to be, the ones that support your own side or your own opinion. And that's exactly what the party was doing in 1984.
Yeah, I could see that. That is a concern today. Though, there must also be said, the media is not always 100% fair or accurate.
Oh, CNN is terrible.
Yeah. I mean,
they're awful.
I love calling them, not that I tweet about politics, but the Counterfeit News Network is a hysterical nickname for them.
You know what?
Pretty funny.
It's not counterfeit.
It's not true. I mean,
I would call it News Light.
I think the more accurate nickname was during the election, calling them the Clinton News Network, because they were kind of in the bag.
You know, CNN, they're really just, like, they're the Budweiser of news.
I think
totally
they're like
watered down.
Yeah, very interested in missing Malaysian planes.
Yeah, just like Budweiser, I'm sure.
A lot of Don Lemon. I mean, CNN blows, so don't sponsor a CNN. Or do, but you still suck.
Yeah, we're still going to say it.
So, yeah, there is shitty news out there. And every news source makes mistakes at one point or another. And sometimes, and there have been things, there has been dishonesty during the election cycle and since, but during the election especially, for both candidates on both, in like both sort of right, like Fox News, left, Fox News Network kind of news, and then left MSNBC/CNN kind of news, where like saying things and then it turns out actually that wasn't really true, or we made a bigger, like, you know, you could say like the way that super right news things are saying like Hillary Clinton has Alzheimer's and dementia because she coughed a lot one day. Mm-hmm.
And
then,
killed Vince Foster.
Well, some stuff is correct, but then you get the like Matt's Rachel Maddow special where she's like, look at Trump's, makes an hour long special out of Trump's tax return she managed to find.
That was after the election.
Was that after the election?
Yeah.
How soon after the election? Because she made that. I was like,
that was after
news.
Inauguration.
Was it really?
He was already president. Yeah.
When was that? I don't know.
I'll fucking look that shit up. Anyway.
I will look that shit up. Just because now I'm just, not because I don't believe you, but I don't believe my own poxy memory.
You're a poxy whore of a memory. Anyway, sorry. I've got like three more reasons if I can
well,
keep going.
Three more reasons. Sure, yeah.
All right. So
oh, you're right. It was March. You're right.
Another thing from 1984 that is eerily a little bit like real life are the 2 minutes hate. Not that the nation
you
does this
that,
totally
yeah.
altogether simultaneously. Although what I want to say is every single time Trump would hold a rally, and it's, you know, broadcast on every single channel, including CNN, those fucks. Anyway, they would broadcast it and Trump would basically do at least 1 2 minutes hate every time. You know,
right, who's
going to
build the wall? Yeah.
Who's going to build the wall? Mexico. They're not going to.
Who's going to pay for this?
Who's going to pay for the wall?
The wall just got 10 feet high. You're right. That, but you know what? That is not unique to Trump. Because they're the same sort of like cheerleading feedback loop stuff happens at tons of political rallies. Because it galvanizes the group against the person that they're voting against or in support of these two on. But it also happens at like sporting events.
Well, yeah, it's true.
Right, like think of sports, like college and high school sports teams who have like rallies, a pep rally before a game. Which kind of sounds really dated. I don't think that happens too often in the city. Maybe out in like the suburbs and stuff.
Listen, those big football colleges,
oh,
they do that.
And everybody,
people die at those.
Yeah, it's crazy. Because, like, not enough. I mean, how is it still happening? Haven't enough of them died yet that we can stop giving a fuck about sports?
Yeah.
But those are that's
like it's ESPN seemed... won't be sponsoring us either.
No, but that's probably because our name might be similar to some sort of in general. Did you hear about Robert Lee?
No.
There was a
Robert Lee.
At this point, it's old news. An Asian American sportscaster was supposed to call like a basketball game in Virginia, University of Virginia game. His name is Robert Lee. Oh, and they were like, that's too close to Robert E. Lee.
No, I did hear about this. Yeah, this is funny.
And now the controversy is like, did they say he couldn't do it or did he choose or they decided together? I believe that there was some pressure to like, listen, Robert Lee, this is probably not the best thing. But like, who the fuck is going to draw that conclusion? Like, Robert E. Lee was not Asian.
Like, listen, that's just funny. That's just funny.
That sounds like a fucking Onion article.
It does.
That's absurd. That was ESPN, so they could sponsor these nuts. That's fucking stupid. All right, so, but I think that sort of, like, rally thing. Trump does it, and it's...
The only rally that carried on national TV that do that and did it over and over, and pretty much every fucking day during the campaign...
It's true.
...were the Trump rallies.
But you know what? What's the vicious cycle of it is it would not... It got covered. He got free press coverage for that shit.
Yeah.
And if it... Sure. Well, if the networks decided, we're not going to cover that, we don't want to show that because... Whatever, we're gonna look at something else. He probably would have done something different to try to get attention,
mm-hmm.
or possibly would have. Right? So yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. Some of the shit they're shouting locker room, people wearing the Hillary for prison shirts. But he's not 100% guilty for that. He's not the only one responsible for that becoming a thing.
I mean, he was rewarded.
That's true.
I mean, he had the incentive to do it because he was rewarded by the media and they covered it. And that's exactly what you're supposed to do when you're running for president.
Yeah, sure.
I can see that.
All right, so how else is it relevant today?
I got more.
You got more? I want to hear it.
Okay.
Lay it on me.
So in the book, there's a slogan, or more like there are three slogans that people say all together. War is peace, war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength.
Right.
I want to say we're living through the ignorance is strength presidency, because the president is ignorant,
sure.
Or at least has no even desire to try to learn anything, and that ignorance brings him strength, or at least people who are ignorant sometimes. Have you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
No, I don't know.
So I'll talk about that in a second. So anyway, I almost feel like being completely ignorant about a subject, or being almost entirely ignorant, gives you the confidence to think that you're right no matter what, which brings you the confidence to, like, go forward and see through whatever thing you think is the best. You know what? That is the Trump's ignorance and the ignorance of his followers. Can I say that?
You could say. Believe whatever you want.
The ignorance of his followers really brings them the strength to be united.
I think that is... I think Trump might be the first person to capitalize on that, but there have always been dopey people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember when I had an argument with someone years ago when Twitter came out and they were telling me how cool Twitter was, and I was saying it's stupid. Saying, I don't understand
Meanwhile,
the point of it.
Follow us at TrumpGuysBC on Twitter.
But I just didn't understand why a regular person has a Twitter. I understand why, you know, if you have something to plug, I understand why you have a Twitter. I understand why, you know, a beer company has a Twitter so they could say, oh, coming out this week, we're putting out our fall beer or whatever the fuck it is. I understand that as a way to just immediately post out information to kind of circumvent the press release kind of form of releasing information. And it's cool that it's like right in your pocket. And if you follow them, you get to keep up with news on stuff. I just don't really understand, and I didn't then, why like a Joe Schmo has a Twitter where it's like Bob from Kentucky has a Twitter and he just posts his thoughts in 140 characters. Like, what are you announcing to the world? I didn't understand that. I just felt it's this egocentrism of Twitter for the average person to just go out there.
Facebook's the same thing.
Well, it's true. Though Facebook started at least as a college thing originally and then became totally different. I mean, once it stopped being just for college students is when I actually got rid of my Facebook.
Yeah, me too.
But well, actually, once my mom had a Facebook page, that's when I was like, no, thank you. So I was arguing with someone. I was like, I think this is stupid. I think it's bad for society because it just makes people dumb. And the person made a good point. They said, actually, those people have always been dumb.
They're just saying it out loud.
You just
now.
Hear them now. Because you didn't interact with them. You didn't cross paths with those stupid people before who mm-hmm. go around and tweet about every fucking meal they eat or every time they take a dump and get it all in the bowl. Now you know that those people are out there and you don't have to ever meet them in person to hear their stupid shit. That's been going on a lot longer than Trump. Trump is just the one who figured out, hey, if I get if I get these people to vote for me, I reach out to these people, I'll get them to vote. But at the same time, I don't demean the voters of Trump and say they're ignorant, stupid people, because a lot of them voted for Trump not because they necessarily liked his rhetoric, but just because he spoke to them directly, the people who felt like, oh, I've been left behind, the government, the economy has changed, and the way that we traditionally earned a living, being, you know, steel workers or whatever, doesn't work anymore, and we wish it would go back to that. And he spoke to those people and said, I'm going to bring it back. Has he done it yet? Of course not. But I don't know if it's fair to say all of his supporters are dopes.
But a lot of people did like that rhetoric.
Sure.
They loved it.
But those people would have liked it if anybody said something like that. They probably would have even liked it if a Democrat said those
kind of things. Yeah, I think they would too, yeah. For sure. Because those people used to be Democrats.
That's true.
Yep. All right, can I just talk about one more thing?
Sure.
So the Dunning-Kruger...
Yeah, yeah, I don't know what this is.
...has to do with a study that two sociologists did, Dunning and Kruger. They were measuring people's skills. I don't know if they were math skills or maybe they just made up something. No, they're probably like math skills or something like that. And then they had people like complete a problem set and then at the end asked people to rate how well they think they did on those problems.
I'm sure everybody thinks
and they
did
found
well.
Something kind of funny, is that people who knew what they were talking about rated themselves fairly accurately. They thought, you know, they did fine. A whole bunch of the people that did incredibly bad rated themselves as doing really well. Like, they rated themselves as being, like, you know, very competent at these skills, when in fact, they knew nothing. They were terrible. Which led the researchers to come up with a point that if you know nothing, if your skills are so bad, or if you know absolutely nothing about a particular set of skills you're supposed to be working in, you have no way to judge how good your skills are.
Hmm.
And so you will overestimate. You have no way of knowing how bad you are until you learn some more so that you can learn how bad you are. And they call this the Dunning-Kruger effect.
So it's overestimating.
So let's just say, when Donald Trump says, who knew healthcare would be this complicated? A fucking idiot.
That's a sign of growth. He's like,
who knew healthcare would be this complicated? Everybody else.
It's true.
It would be this complicated.
So the point of the effect is that, like, the true ignorance or true incompetence is that you don't even know you're incompetent.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You are unaware of being how incompetent you are.
Well, we don't know
that
because we're fucking awesome at drinking and talking about books.
But that ignorance gives you strength.
Well, I don't wanna argue against you, but let's get this last beer over
here.
Yeah,
we got another beer. All right,
wait,
so
on,
our last beer. This is from Founders Brewery, and this is called Dissenter.
So this
because is Winston, the main character, is definitely
I gotta reuse a cup.
A so. Dissenter.
Yeah, totally. Put it in there. I noticed this is a Imperial. It's not an IPA. That was interesting. We almost went all IPAs. It's an IPL.
Mm. What's the difference between an IPA and IPL?
Well, first of all, IPL is a fucking fictitious style of beer. So there's like a lot of different things, right? There are recognized styles of beer, of which there are probably close to 60 at this point.
Wow.
You know, India Pale Ale, Imperial India Pale Ale, Stout, Porter, Smoked Beer, Fruit Beer, Pump, you know, Imperial Stout, all these things. The difference here is between an ale and a lager. So those are your two broad categories of beer, ale and lager, which really come down to a couple of basic categories, and I'm sure some beer snobs will say I'm really not giving it enough attention. But I fucking know what I'm talking about. I'm just making it simple. The difference comes down to, one, the type of yeast that's used. So all beer uses a certain like family of yeast, but different strains of those yeasts. And ale yeast and lager yeast are kind of different subcategories. Those yeasts then work. One group of yeast kind of floats while it makes the beer, while it turns the sugar water into beer. And the other one sinks and does it from the bottom. So top, what they call top flocculating yeast and bottom flocculating yeast, right? Where it hangs out the top of the bottom. Which makes a difference, it makes a difference on how the flavors come out of the beer. It makes a difference in that sense. That's probably the most important thing. Then lagers are usually fermented and then stored for several weeks, or what the process is called lagering, at a colder temperature. So an ale can ferment beer at 50, 60, 70 degrees. And, you know, room temperature, whereas a lager, it should be cooler, which actually, because of that, like, one of the general rules of thumb for beer is you should serve it at the temperature it was brewed at. So theoretically, ale should be served a little warmer than lagers. So lagers tend to have a cleaner taste, less other flavors in there. So IPL is just really, it's a fucking hoppy as shit lager, or you could just, it's an IPA done with a lager yeast instead of an ale yeast. Is it really different than an IPA? I don't have the kind of palate that I could tell you. I think this tastes like a really great IPA. I noticed this is a 2014 vintage.
Not overly, it's not as strong as the Ripple Rouser.
It's up there in alcohol. I think it's about the same strength, right? 8.7 or something?
It's 8.7.
This is actually
a
hair stronger.
And I got a really big bottle, too, of very strong beer. Oh boy.
It's all right. We'll take our time. It's a really great beer. It tastes like an IPA to me, really. I couldn't tell you taste-wise that this is not an IPA. So I wonder why brewers do that. I wonder if that's some sort of marketing thing. Just because there are so many IPAs, if you have something that is not an IPA, it probably gets a little more attention. You know, you think of, like, Sam Adams makes five just Rebel IPAs, plus they have a couple of other IPAs out of their They probably make 40 or 50 different beers throughout the year, but that's a good proportion of our IPAs. And they're not even known as an IPA brewery. Mm-hmm. Like Dogfish Head is a big IPA brewery, and they make like 10 different IPAs that are, you know, all really good actually, but mostly really good, but very different types of IPAs. So if you have something that says IPL, that stands out on the shelf. It looks different. So I think that's what they're doing here. What do you think of our four beers, our Rebels and Dissenters?
They're all good.
I might have to go for the Dissenter. That's the highlight here. I was like trying to read on the label if it has like one of those cool little stories about the beer, but it's actually just a whole bunch of bullshit from the Surgeon General. Fuck
yeah,
off.
Fuck him. What does he know?
Eat a dick. You get people to stop smoking, you could talk to me about drinking. I'm not nursing or pregnant. Yeah, this was a fun book to get beers for because there are so many different things you can go off of. Mm-hmm. Like one of the things that's important about the book is that there are so many phrases from it that have entered into common discourse. Just like things people say. Big Brother, probably the most famous.
Yeah.
But the idea of doublethink, people don't say doublethink so often, but you certainly hear groupthink. I hear that term a lot. Mm-hmm. That's definitely derived from 1984. There was a shitty TV show in England called Room 101.
And a show called Big Brother.
Yep, yeah, which was also shitty in both sides of the pond. There's a shitty American version.
I've actually never seen any of them.
I haven't either. I'm just assuming it's shitty. But, you know, in the effect that you described of my complete incompetence, I don't know how wrong I am. I'm certain it was shitty. One of the things people say from the book, Rebel from the Waist Down was a line in a Marilyn Manson song, which for years I thought Marilyn Manson wrote. I thought it was really cool when I was an angry teenager. And then I found out it was in 1984 and I felt betrayed.
Betrayed.
I was like, no, Marilyn, you lied to me. He didn't lie. I just was dopey and didn't know. But there's other things from the book. What else is kind of... just like certain lines people might say from the book and people recognize at least the meaning of it, even if they don't recognize the origin. You know, like we were always at war with East Asia
or
whatever
it was.
That's
what I was going
to say, yeah. That one's... people say variations on that.
The Thought Police.
That's true. Thought Police is a big one. It's like a whole article. You want me to read it?
If you want
a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. It's just unnecessary, man. Power is in tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. I believe that's also just called education. I mean, there are different things in the book that resonate that even people who've never read the book know about the book for some reason. It's just that common an experience for people. I never read it in school. I never had a class where we were supposed to read it.
I didn't either.
Which I'm kind of surprised about, because I think a lot of people do read this in school, but I'm a little disappointed I didn't, because I really liked it. I read it when I was about high school age, maybe early college, and I loved it.
I read it after college.
It is an important book. His vision for the book was sort of the Soviet Union model, which we know didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Failed. Spoiler. Spoiler, the Soviet Union doesn't make it.
Yeah.
But, you know, lasted for a long-ass time. Is there anywhere today that, you know, we could draw ominous parallels with the United States? But is there any place that looks like this today?
Well, obviously, the closest has to be North Korea.
Fair.
A couple of things that definitely stand out from the book. Okay, so first of all, the sort of overall idea of, you know, the Big Brother is watching you, and the sort of, like, thought control of the state. In North Korea, that's called Juche. That's called the Juche ideology, which was mostly an invention of Kim Jong-il, not the guy who's there now, his father. That was actually after the fall of the Soviet Union. Another thing that, like, really struck me is that if you're at all reported for being, for even saying or acting in any way, or even suspected of thinking in any way that would be against the regime, you are sent to a prison camp. You are sent to a re-education camp, and not just you, three generations of your family. For people who defect... The threat against defectors is that three generations of your family will be spent in the gulag in North Korea. And these are huge, sprawling prison complexes where it is really one of the worst places to be alive on the planet today. And just in North Korea, everyone watches everyone else. I mean, they don't have, like, technology in North Korea, except for their, you know, military, which they spend most of their GDP on. But they don't really have technology, but they get the people to watch each other and report each other. And one of the little stories in the beginning of 1984 is that it's celebrated when children turn in their parents. Hmm. When children report on their parents saying anything slightly, you know, not wanted. That actually happens in North Korea. You know, when children end up going to school 5, 6, 7 years old, before children are really capable of lying or really understanding what's going on, their teachers will ask them, have your parents ever said this? Have your parents ever said that? Have your parents ever done this? Have your parents ever done that? I mean, that also happened in the Soviet Union, but it definitely happens in North Korea. It definitely happened in China during the Cultural Revolution and during the Great Leap Forward. And that happened after Orwell was already dead.
Yeah, he didn't live much longer than the book.
Yeah, he died about a year after the book was published. But a whole bunch of things that he wrote about in 1984 turned out to come true in other places in the world.
You know, I thought of yet another thing that has stolen an idea from that. Is that a shitty Christian Bale movie, Equilibrium? You ever see that?
I have not seen
that. That's terrible. It's another dystopian thing where the children give up, like, their parents, and that happens to his wife. The kids had turned in the wife they turn in someone. They turn in, like, some female character. I'm not sure if it was wife or not. Terrible movie. Don't watch it. But stole that idea from... And he wasn't wearing hockey pads. Stole that idea from this, too, it sounds like. So North Korea is just this nightmarish place to live. And you kind of, you know, one of the things I guess you always wonder as a non-North Korean, how do the people just tolerate that? And if you live in that world where you have no external information, everything's controlled by the government, and you are watched all the time, whether it's by the government or the people around you or both, there's no room to think of other things.
No.
It's a very effective form of thought control, you know, if you want to take over the entire civilization and do that to people. It's kind of scary that that exists, but it makes sense of why the people of North Korea just tolerate or endure the shittiness that is happening in their country, which is a drag.
Also in the book, in 1984, the book within the book by Goldstein, it sort of explains why, one of the reasons why there's perpetual war, because why society needs to always be at war with other people, and it's so that the country as a whole doesn't really get luxury. They don't really get resources. They're always constantly, they're constantly starved and without things that they need, and that's so people don't get the idea that they're equal, and that keeps people in power. But here's the thing. So one of the ways that war gets rid of the excess resources, they put all of that into military technology. And you know what? That's exactly what North Korea does. They have the world's fourth biggest military, but they have no electricity in most places. In the 90s, over 1 million people, possibly 2 million people, starved in a famine because they didn't have food. And still, they were already working on the nuclear weapons program.
That is a crazy, scary kind of list of statistics there.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you ever think, you know, whenever we read a dystopian book, not just for our podcast, but in general, you look for the parallels with your world. Do you wonder maybe it's just being cynical, you see them? You know, like, because every dystopian book I've read, I could think of some way that, like, ooh, that's kind of like what we do. They can't all be right.
Well, it's clearly not 100% right.
Right, but just say all of these things. You know, it's not just 1984, right? It's Fahrenheit 451. We talked about people not wanting to read and people being dummies. For the same kind of thing. Like, you got the result right, but the cause wrong, as Orwell does with the surveillance. We see these things in our world, and we take the pessimistic view of them and say, "Oh, this is us on our path towards a shitty, awful world." Probably at any point in history, there have been shitty, awful things for the majority of society.
So you're saying that if you just open your imagination to how shitty people can be to each other, you'll probably be right at some point.
Is that wrong? I think that's fair. I think I agree with that. Imagine something terrible, and then try to imagine something terrible
that hasn't happened
somehow or somewhere.
Hasn't happened? That's much harder than imagining what hasn't happened.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff you pay a lot of money for at a bondage sex dungeon. Which is creatively abuse me.
That costs extra.
Right? Shittiness has happened all over the world. Governments are flawed. People are deeply flawed. Bad things happen, and awful, heartbreaking things happen. Maybe that's why we like dystopias, because
it seems kind of real.
It does seem kind of real. It seems possible, but it also isn't as bad. It's worse than whatever shittiness you live in now, right? Even if you take the most negative view of America in 2017, you can. 1984 is worse by a country mile. So do you have any more reasons why it's relevant today? Do we get through them all?
I probably do. Yeah. Can I think of any?
I think the most important one for me is really the surveillance piece. And knowing that when you do something, it's probably being watched, that must have been a radical idea in 1948, I would think.
Well, maybe not, because there were all those, like, propaganda things about, like, oh, the sneaky Japs are listening.
Like, when you ride alone, you ride with Hitler.
Yes, that's an awesome poster, yeah. Right, all those, you know, like, the loose lips sink ships kind of idea that if you say things, people are listening. So maybe that idea isn't brand new with Orwell, but the idea of it being recorded and documented and filmed, that's new. And that's just him taking technology that was new and combining it with this wartime paranoia, which it turns out was often, there were reasons to be paranoid.
Yeah.
Right, there were spies. Oh, yeah. So, you know. Not to return to our Da Vinci Code from a few weeks ago conspiracy theory thing, but part of what makes it interesting is that every once in a while, there were spies. Every once in a mm-hmm. while, things were exactly how you were made to be afraid of it.
There are real conspiracy.
The conspiracy of why we are not the number one podcast on iTunes. It's clearly by the wine lobby. So the ending. Can we talk about the ending?
Oh, yeah.
The ending, at the end of the book, we already said it a while ago. Winston sells out his girl. She sells him out. He's in a cafe, and there's this song, and they mentioned this earlier in the book about, like, the chestnut tree, and I sold you, and you sold me, or something like that. And he sees these other men crying when they hear the song. And when you first read that scene, and you're like, pussies. But then later on, Winston realizes the true meaning of the song, that this is, like, some and I'm not sure now if it's the government just giving a big middle finger to them, saying, I got you, bitches. But it reminds him of what they've done. And he then thinks about all the shit that he got from Big Brother. The Big Brother fixed his glasses and fixed his leg thing that was wrong with his ankle or whatever. Fixed his teeth. And he loves Big Brother. So the state wins. Big Brother wins. Why?
Why is that Orwell's message that the state wins rather than, if we just are vigilant, this won't happen?
Yeah, like, why isn't it in, like, the fucking Hunger Games and they go and destroy the government?
It's not a young adult novel.
True, but... You know, happy endings happen.
You know, this is Orwell, you know, at the end of his life. Not that he was actually that old. But
he had,
anyway,
like, tuberculosis or something. He was dying.
You know, maybe he was particularly pessimistic at the time when he was writing this.
But is there a message? Is there, like, a lesson to learn? Like, so much of the other book, we look for some sort of lessons in it. Is there some lesson in the ending? Or are we just choosing to ignore that ending part?
I mean, here's my theory. We're making it so that the state wins. Orwell is trying to make people even more afraid about the future that he lays out in 1984. To be even more afraid that this really could happen. And that if we as a society let things get to this point, if we allow totalitarianism up to this point, then the state will win, and then it will be too late. Then there's nothing we can do. So I guess we need to stop fascism now. We need to stop totalitarianism now before it gets started. Maybe that's what he's saying.
I tend to agree. And I think by saying Winston tried to rebel, and he was just one guy, and he got totally crushed. So it was like the individual, he's weak against the state. Yeah, I think the whole idea, like, going against the state, you're not going to win, is a bummer. It's pessimistic, but maybe that's just to make this. But the problem is, how do you recognize when you're on the path to that?
Yeah.
Because we don't look at every single piece of legislation and judicial and political action and say, is this a little closer to 1984 or a little farther from 1984? We never get into that. People just kind of use this as a way to describe things they don't like.
All right. I hope you liked what we said. We kind of went on a really long time. Tell us what you thought. Send us an email at drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter at drunkguysbc, even if Twitter is dumb. Join us next time when we read The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving.